You are listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you're hearing a conversation with Brian David Johnson, whose book MWD, Hell is Coming Home, came out earlier this year from Candlewick Press. Brian David Johnson is the Boston, Massachusetts-based author of MWD, Hell is Coming Home, out earlier this year from Candlewick Press. He is an accomplished journalist and media entrepreneur who has successfully launched several niche media, sports, and business publications and live events that have entertained and informed millions of readers over the past 10 years. He has written for the Associated Press, Boston Globe, and the New York Times, and was a staff reporter for the Eagle Tribune newspaper. He lives in Brookline, Massachusetts, with his wife and two children. MWD, Hell is Coming Home, is a moving graphic novel that follows a young woman's return from war and her bond with two dogs, one who saves her life in Iraq and another who helps her reclaim it at home. MWD stands for Military Working Dogs. Liz served in Iraq with her trusty military working dog Ender by her side, but now that her tour is over, she has to readjust to life in her small New Hampshire town. Despite being surrounded by people she's known her whole life, Liz feels entirely alone and soon gets trapped in a downward spiral of flashbacks and blackout drinking. Things seem destined for a bad end, but when Liz's on-again, off-again boyfriend Ben almost hits a stray dog while she is in the car, things start to change. Brutus might be the only thing that can bring her back from the brink. Brian David Johnson, Jan Eagleson, and Layla Milevsky, and Carl Stevens have created a searing and honest portrait of reentry to civilian life after war and a touching exploration of the bond between dog and human. When I spoke with Brian David Johnson, I began by asking him how he came to write MWD, Hell is Coming Home, and to talk about the history of the project.
So, I mean, I have a great visual cue for this. My son was born in August of 2007, and when we did the book reading, when the book came out, I brought him up to the front of the stage, and he's almost 10 years old now. So I said, well, when we started writing this, this kid was an infant. So Jan Eagleson is a filmmaker and a professor at Boston University. He's been around the film scene for 40 years, and he actually takes Pilates lessons from my wife. And I was a reporter at a newspaper for a few years, and then I got a little burnt out, and I said, hey, I want to try writing some fiction stuff and maybe take a job that doesn't have me writing every day so I'm a little less burnt out at night. And I wrote a pilot for a TV show, and my wife introduced me to Jan, and then Jan read the pilot and really liked it. But he co-opted me to help him write another project, and he had an interest that we met at a coffee shop, and he had a very kind of sparse idea, and he said, I want to make a movie about a female veteran coming home from war, and I want her to have been a dog handler, and I want her to be really, really troubled and by her experiences in war, and then I want her to have had the dog taken away from her, and that all of her sort of PTSD is channeled into this dog and missing this dog. And that was basically the idea. And he said that, and I want it to be like a French movie. I don't want anything to happen. So I wanted to, so I was like, oh, okay.
Great.
And, you know, I love 70s movies. So I was kind of excited by the idea of one of these sort of slowly unfolding movies that when it ends, you feel really emotionally drained.
Okay.
You kind of don't know where you got punched in the stomach, but you know you did.
Can you give an example of a 70s movie that does that?
Well, kind of every one of them, actually. Like, I don't know, Cool Hand Luke, I think. Well, that's a 60s movie, but I mean, Midnight Cowboy, which I guess is also a 60s movie. I think I'm just kind of blending late 60s, 70s.
That's okay.
You know, they're very, they put you in a place, and they kind of slowly put you in there, and there's not the same big boom, boom action kind of stuff going on.
Right.
So, I mean, I quite quickly realized, okay, it's very hard to write a story where nothing happens. So I was lucky in that my sister-in-law, one of them, worked with veterans, and particularly female veterans.
Yeah.
And my other sister-in-law was a dog trainer. And I dug into research, and we were able to really find a story there, and quickly kind of realized that there were some major themes we had to hit in terms of telling the female soldier's story. And that's kind of how the story evolved from there. So we did the classic, how you write a screenplay is, you know, you start very small and just start building the backstory, and then you take index cards and you write scenes out on the index cards, and then you shuffle those around. And, you know, after a lot of work and a lot of back and forth and sometimes arguing, actually a lot of times arguing,
yeah.
You come up with a story. And so, you know, our first draft was a screenplay. It was a very, I would say, a complex story. It was a bit of a bigger story. It had a lot of different beats to it. And so it kind of evolved from there.
Yeah. So how did it go from being a script with a lot of different beats and kind of complex into a graphic novel?
Sure. Well, Jan and I sort of ran around the gambit trying to, he wanted to direct the movie pretty badly. And we had producers and contacts out there, and there was a lot of interest in the story. We kind of spun our tires a little bit on it. And then he was actually in a pitch meeting at Candlewick Press, because he had written another book about his father's experience in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt that it wasn't appropriate for them. And they had asked kind of on the way out, hey, what else do you got? And he said, well, I have this thing. You probably don't want it. It's about, a woman coming home from war, yada, yada. And they said, well, we'd really like to read that. We think it's a subject we'd like to explore, especially because there has this dog element to it.
Right.
And so they took the screenplay, they read it, and they called us in, said we really like it, and we'd like to turn it into a graphic novel. And we think it could be appropriate for teenagers, which was kind of interesting to both of us, because we really felt that we had written this as a gritty, sort of grayscaled movie. The most important thing for all of us was to make sure the project lived.
Yeah.
And we took the opportunity, and I felt that it was a really interesting venue for it. Graphic novels have always been something I really enjoy. It's a different kind of reading. It's kind of almost reading without reading. You go through it so fast. It's so visual. You really don't have any room for exposition. So I love the challenge of converting it into a graphic novel. I thought it was really freeing in terms of story structure.
Yeah, and actually it's interesting, the fact that it started as a script, that, you know, they both are very visual experiences, you know, to watch a film and to read a graphic novel. I imagine that there were some aspects of it that translated very well into that particular transformation. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, the final manuscript is essentially a screenplay. We didn't offer too many visual cues. Maybe that in sort of common graphic novels, it's a little more technical.
Yeah.
There's more like panel instructions and things like that.
Now, you say that you were very familiar with the genre, and you've read a lot of graphic novels. Did you have to learn like more specific guidelines to write in this form, or did you just sort of wing it and then figure it out with your publisher after?
You know, we just kind of wrote it as a screenplay and figured it all out as we go. Interestingly, now I've spent a lot more time studying structure of graphic novels and trying to understand how you write in graphic novel formatting. And I'm sort of still figuring it out as I go. I think it's best, actually, if you write a manuscript first that's sort of like a screenplay, and then when you work with the illustrator, then you can do more panel descriptions and things like that.
Now, when you talk to children's authors for, you know, picture books or books with other illustration, you know, they don't always even interact at all with their illustrator or have any sort of knowledge of who their illustrator is going to be right up front or any vote that they get. So it's interesting that with graphic novels, it sounds like you do work pretty closely with your illustrator.
You do. We didn't in this case, but you do.
Oh, okay.
And I think you should in a lot of respects because, I mean, I'm a big believer in collaborative process. And it's exciting to me to hear an illustrator's input in terms of how do you visually render something like that, a big moment, you know.
Right.
You know, it's if I was an illustrator, I'd probably write a more technical manuscript, but you know, I'm also a big believer in kind of letting people, professionals, do their job.
Well, that's an interesting point. You know, there's a lot of subject matter in this book. MWD, Hell is Coming Home is the name of the book. So there's a lot of information in here that could be handled very technically. You know, you've got war, you've got combat scenes, you have the working dog scenes, and it worked so well just as like a visual, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of explication of the technical aspects of this plot. Yeah, it's cool how well it works, actually.
Thank you. You know, what we really tried was, I mean, and I swear to God, you know, we had scenes with therapists in them. And I realized like when I was reading it, like, what are we doing? You can't, no one wants to read a comic book where there's a therapist scene in it. No disrespect to therapists, of course, but, you know, I think that was the real challenge of the story was how do you convey really complex subjects such as post-traumatic stress disorder? How do you portray triggers of sexual abuse? How do you portray longing in a visual sense and not explain it? And I think that's the beauty of this book in my estimation in terms of my own pride in it is that I do feel like as authors we did a really good job of telling a complex story just by showing and not telling.
Yeah, I agree. Let's talk a little bit about the storyline. The story concerns Liz, a veteran recently returned from Iraq, where she worked with a military working dog, which is what MWD stands for. And the dog's name was Ender. She has PTSD, both from combat experience and also, you know, to some extent from being mistreated and even sexually manipulated by her fellow soldiers. So
yeah.
I wonder if you can talk about developing Liz's character.
Yeah, so I mean, Liz is an amalgam of many different female veteran stories that I studied. You know, I felt it was really critical not to base her on a real person.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we really wanted to tell was a story about what one particular female soldier went through. This is not every female soldier doesn't go through all these different. I would say horrors, but actually a lot of them do.
Yeah.
And there's an incredibly high rate of sexual abuse in the military.
Yeah.
You know, there's one woman for every 9 men that served in that operation Enduring Freedom, an operation Iraqi Freedom. And it's an incredibly tense situation filled with adrenaline and contraband alcohol and drugs and young people living in kind of, I would say, the hardest conditions you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of mental stress. So I had a picture of Liz in my head from, I was a newspaper reporter up in Salem, New Hampshire, Derry, New Hampshire. So, you know, I felt very strongly she should be a small town kid, kind of a tough kid.
Right.
Sort of a prototypical Southern New Hampshire woman, you know, beautiful, but also really made hard, you know, by a lot of different factors, you know, a hard upbringing, harsh climate,
you know,
too many cigarettes, too much drinking.
Right.
But I wanted her to also have gone to war and to have served nobly and have, this had been, it was important to me that for her, this experience was the first realization in her life that she mattered. And, you know, that was really my covenant, sort of my baseline with her. You know, she's kind of a tough character to get her hands around, but she's also on the inside really a good person who's just kind of struggling with meaning and struggling to kind of find her place in the world. And, you know, I got to say, I felt, having spent a lot of time in that area of the world, kind of rural America in the mid-aughts, that there were a lot of kids like that, men and women, who were just kind of finding themselves post 9/11. You know, the world seemed a lot different.
Yeah.
The world was a lot harder. You know, some people were doing well, but most people the bottom was starting to fall out of the economy.
Right.
And war, going to war was a real option because they couldn't afford college because their parents hadn't prepared. And they, you know, had this sort of call to patriotism from 9/11, but really mostly they went to war because they needed something in their life to provide them with meaning. And I think that really was the mental background of what Liz was. And then what we did after that was added elements of what somebody who works with animals, they are a little bit different. They tend to, you know, I think sometimes understand animals better than humans,
yeah.
Interact better with animals than humans.
Yeah.
So there was that element we wanted to put in. And then, you know, I think one of the things you see in the book is, you know, in the early pages, you kind of see that Liz is sassy and kind of still fun. But then as the book goes on and you follow her home, you see, you know, she's really struggling. And it was important for us to really have that be accurate and authentic.
Right. Now, you have said we, and I want to just mention that this book has two authors and two illustrators. So I'm wondering how that worked. How did you work together to organize yourselves?
We is kind of a verbal tic I use because I'm in the entrepreneurial world, and you always say we instead of I. But this was a collaborative effort. Jan and I, so Jan and I would work together in a couple of respects. We would get together and we did a lot of collaborative work in blocking out. So I would kind of come up with the scenes and then we'd come together and we'd work on sort of where they were going to go. And he spent a lot of time, I would say, working on the character development. So I would bring him pages that I had written and scenes. And he would read them and he would say, well, what if she does this? And what if she does that? And it was a very good mix because I'm very, as a reporter, you know, I don't like to make leaps in logic. I wanted everything to be substantiated.
Right.
As a dramatist, he did not care one bit about leaps in logic and would often want me to have the Liz character do something completely unexplained and say, I just want her to do this. And like he was saying, if he felt it, like, I just feel like she'll do this. And I think what that helped create was the sense that at any moment, Liz could turn on a dime. And I think it did give her a lot of life, and it challenged me to make those work. So his curveballs, and then I would sit there and I would have to sort of justify them in my head with evidence and facts. So that worked out pretty well because what we were able to do in some respects was create a much more authentic narrative and I think a better rounded character that actually in the end I think is a lot more a lot better example of what an actual person going through this kind of experience would be like.
Yeah. And then why two illustrators? How did that happen?
You know, so Candlewick Press, we submitted the manuscript and then Candlewick Press went on a long search for an illustrator. And illustrators are in kind of short supply.
Okay.
Strangely enough. Well, ones that can complete a 160-page book. We found a great illustrator named Carl Stevens, and Carl did the first 30 pages, really the Iraq stuff. and then we found Layla for the rest of it. And I think, you know, some of that was scheduling, and then some of it was narrative, and that we wanted to have a real distinct separation between what happens in war and what happens at home.
Right.
They blended a little more than I thought they were going to. You know, I think what we wanted was very crisp, clear visuals for the Iraq scenes, because in war your senses are heightened.
And, oh, interesting.
And,
yeah.
And at home, we wanted more of a cloudy process, because, you know, we thought that visually that would be a great cue for what soldiers experience when they come home, because they often describe it as kind of being wrapped in saran wrap when you come home. You know, you're home, but you're not home. You know, you have a really hard time texturalizing, like, gee, this is home, you know, but you feel kind of like an alien. So we, you know, that was visually what we try to do.
It is, now that I'm thinking about it, it is visually very different between the war and the home return. And I like the rationale behind that.
I've always hoped that someday we could have like a companion website where you could actually get all this stuff explained, and like, I mean, because I think there's a lot of interesting visual cues in there about PTSD that I would love for people to explore deeper.
Yeah.
You know, that we just kind of put in there because they're true, but didn't want to explain.
Yeah. Let's see. Women weren't in combat when you began this book years ago, 10 years ago. So in talking right. to women who serve, or in researching, have you heard a lot of feedback about how they feel this transition has been handled?
I have not, because, I mean, most of my research happened prior to the change.
Oh, right. Yeah, sure.
But I think it's safe to say, just as a casual observer, the transition has been rocky.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's a lot of real problems and issues with how we understand women serving in war. And I think they're worth exploring deeper. You know, one of the scenes in the book that has turned out to be one of the most accurate, which I'm shocked by, is the scene in the beginning when they're playing Truth or Dare, and the soldier films it and then puts it on the internet.
Right.
And, you know, I wrote that scene years ago, never thinking it was going to be something that would be accurate. And you know, all these years later, my God, it was absolutely prescient. I mean, when you think about the Marine Facebook group, and I think, you know, it's disgusting that stuff happens. You know, like, I think more attention needs to be paid to how our female soldiers are treated.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
And as you say, you know, a lot of these soldiers are so young and maybe not making the decisions they would make, you know, 10 years later. But the internet is a terrible temptation, I think. You know what I mean? It's just so easy to throw something on the internet.
Yeah, and we kind of felt, you know, that was kind of, at that point, cyberbullying was starting to bubble up in the public consciousness.
Yeah.
So we kind of thought that this was an interesting narrative play. But, I mean, we never thought it would ever be accurate in terms of soldiers putting compromising pictures of their fellow soldiers up on the web for
right.
enjoyment. We never thought that was going to happen. In fact, I was really worried that would seem totally false, and much to my surprise, it was not false at all. So
yeah,
it's interesting how that kind of sometimes that happens as a writer. You know, you think something is totally out of left field, and it turns out to be one of the more accurate things that you actually have,
right.
have written.
Right. Yeah. Now, you have mentioned doing research. So what were your research sources like? What were you doing?
I talked to a lot of people at the VA.
Yeah.
Yeah, I talked to the heads of the women's clinics and did a ton of research in that sense.
I would think your journalism background came in very handy there.
Yeah. I have a source document file that is probably 2 feet tall.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I needed everything I could possibly think of. I needed pictures of Iraq. I needed I talked to, and I spent a lot of time talking to my sister-in-law.
Yes.
Watching videos of dog training and things like that. So I was pretty much having to learn about almost everything in the book. So I was very much, it was so important to me that everything be authentic that I was doubly careful.
Yeah.
I didn't want to even write in the exposition notes, basically anything that wouldn't be accurate. So I needed to know names of military bases and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
That was really important to me.
Now, your sister-in-law works with dogs, and a big part of this story is the military working dogs. Mm-hmm. So, did she know specifically about military working dogs, or was she just able to tell you about sort of how dogs respond to different training techniques, and then maybe you talk to some people in the military about the dogs that work with the military?
Well, so she's a trainer in the school called Schutzen, which is German Shepherd kind of police dog.
Oh, okay.
Training, so tracking and obedience and attack, all that stuff.
So that's very relevant, I would think.
Yeah, and German Shepherds, and actually one of her dogs was kind of my model for the dog in the beginning of the book.
Okay.
Down to his name, even. Yeah. And actually, I gave pictures of him to the illustrator and said, "This is your dog. Like, this is what we're looking at." Other things I did to give the dog's personality was I actually watched the movie The Thing, and they have a great dog in that, you know, really I just was kind of studied his movements, and I spend a lot of time watching movies when I write, because I don't want to read too much. Kind of a bizarre, you know, I get nervous that I'm going to lose my confidence if I read, because I'm always feeling like I'm not, you know, a great writer. So I'm always watching movies to try and find narrative structure that I can use in my own story. So project I take, I sort of base it. I say, okay, this is like this movie and this movie and this movie. And then I watch those movies and kind of break them down and structurally, and then find things that I like. So,
oh, interesting.
For the Brutus dog, I watched the movie The Thing, and there's a dog in that I would just loved the way he walked around. He sort of had this preternatural calm, and I kind of said, okay, that's how our dog's going to be, and used him as a model.
Yeah.
So, you know, you try to pull in any sort of inspirational material you can without copying anybody.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about your hope for the book's impact. You mentioned in your end notes that it was a meditative treatise on PTSD, and you've also talked about navigating sexual politics. And so just sort of overall, what is your hope for how this book will impact an audience, and particularly an audience of maybe more teenagers than any other age?
You know, it's an interesting question, because, I mean, you know, my hopes have always been that it will be impactful to the person who reads it, and maybe they'll learn something new about female soldiers and what they go through.
Right.
You know, my own personal hopes. I hope I get another chance to write one. We'll see. You know, I think it's a really authentic, good story.
Yeah.
I feel like it will have a long shelf life. Yeah. I have no idea, you know, maybe in 10 years it'll be even more impactful than it is today. You know, I sometimes worry that we've become so obsessed with what's going on in Washington that it's leaving so little air for people to discover new topics. I think right now the public consciousness is very clouded with external events in Washington, D.C. So I feel like this, maybe the book didn't get its just desserts in terms of how it would impact now. But I do feel like the book will stand the test of time, and that people will read it, and you know, I have no idea if they'll say, hey, I want to serve in the military. I don't want to serve in the military because of this. You know, I hope it becomes a book that people read and say, oh, that was what it was like in 2004 and 05, you know, during the war in Iraq. And, I think there's, I think what we saw in the Vietnam War was a lot of the literature and movies that were, really impactful didn't come, didn't really surface until 10, 20 years later. But if at the end of the day, if just people read it and they understand what female soldiers go through or went through to make this bridge happen, then I think it's a good, then it's a great impact. So that's, that's all you can hope for, is that people read it and say, hey, that was interesting.
Yes. Let's talk a little bit about the way that you are bringing the book out into the world. Do you have any, are you doing anything with veterans groups? Are you doing any sort of like collaborative readings with any other writers or groups?
I've done a few readings, and mostly I've done a lot of radio.
Mm-hmm.
I have a pretty packed life outside of this pursuit. I'm a magazine publisher and an event producer, so I have a tremendous amount of duties in my real life.
Right.
this is my hobby.
And kids besides.
And two kids. So my job is my hobby, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
If we will continue to work to bring it out. I have worked with some experts in PTSD. I brought those folks to my readings and to explain. So a friend is a neuroscientist who is working on a giant initiative to really physiologically understand PTSD. We don't know a whole lot about the condition. What we do know is that it impacts a lot more people than soldiers.
Right.
What we do know is that it's a lasting scar in your brain as a result of trauma.
Yeah.
It's still basically, to diagnose PTSD, you're looking at a whole host of symptoms, and there's a Venn diagram around, and if you're on one side of the Venn diagram, maybe you have depression. If you're on the other side, you have PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
So we continue to work together to find ways in which to get this story out there through that group. And, we'll continue to seek ways to educate people on it.
Yeah. Okay, great. You mentioned Vietnam a minute ago when we were talking about, some of the movies that came out of earlier conflicts. I'm wondering, as you did your research, if there were Vietnam vets that you spoke to. It's interesting, in this book, there's a Vietnam vet who's very supportive of Liz. His name is Jack. Mm-hmm. Is that based on stories that you heard? Are there Vietnam vets that are helping some of these younger vets as they return?
It's interesting. My brother just spent time working at the VA. He followed kind of in my sister-in-law's footsteps, so he was counseling soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there is a lot. I don't think there's a ton of Vietnam veterans that are kind of jumping in to help returning soldiers now. But I think it is accurate that the only person that can understand what a soldier coming home from war is another soldier who served. And I think there has been there's a lot of validity to that. And I know that, one-to-one basis is that soldiers will seek out other soldiers to talk about their experiences. And then I've had actually great feedback from Vietnam veterans who have read the book, who really feel like we captured the feeling that you have when you come home from war, which is fantastic.
That's great. Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. Let's see. I want to ask you, just as a reader, is there anything that you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners?
So I read Bag of Bones by Stephen King.
Oh yeah.
Which actually was fantastic. And then Ponzi's Scheme by my, old professor, Mitch Zukov. Who's been a great influence on me in my career.
Oh, great.
Which is a fantastic book. I think, Mitch knows how to make narrative nonfiction really sing. And he spends a lot of time surfing the microfiche room at the BU library to find his stories. I asked him once, like, where do you find this? He's like, oh, I spent an inordinate amount of time in the basement of the Boston University Library looking through newspapers from the 40s for interesting things. But I think Ponzi's scheme is really, I would definitely recommend that because it's still so, it's such an important story still to know today.
Okay. All right. Great. And so he taught you, what were you pursuing? What degree were you getting?
So I have a master's degree in business and economics journalism from Boston University.
Oh, okay. Great.
And I have a film degree from Emerson.
Oh.
So I chose the most lucrative professions you could find.
Now, your film degree, was that a bachelor's degree?
Yeah, okay. It was.
All right, cool. So what are you working on now? You say you're hoping that you're going to get to publish another graphic novel. Are you working on one?
I've written actually two. So I'm in that really wonderful place where you have two rough drafts done and then struggling to do the work to actually make them great. you know, I think the problem with your first book taking years to come out is that, you know, you do 10 to 15 rewrites, and only when you get to that point can you actually make something that's really great. And so, you know, I'm really chopping through these two. So I think they're great ideas and really interesting stories, and you know, at least one of them has really great characters. But, you know, there's a lot of work to be done still on that. And I think that's the challenge of writing is, you know, I've been a professional writer for a decade now, and I've always found that when you start writing for money, it does change your process. And particularly with fiction, which is my passion, you know, I have to have, I think I have to have clear purpose and pure purposes. You know, I have to write because I love writing.
Right.
And it's, it can be difficult sometimes.
Yeah. Now, are the projects you're working on now, are those collaborative, or are you doing those on your own?
I'm doing them on my own.
Okay.
And then, we will enlist an illustrator and sell them as a package. I also, am working on a project with my brother, who's an illustrator as well.
Oh, okay.
So I'm constantly trying to find new ways. I'd like to, I love the graphic novel medium. It's an excruciatingly long process. I mean, it takes almost 2 years to illustrate a project. So you take 2 years to write a book, and then it's another 2 years to get it out to the world at minimum.
Yeah.
It's tough.
All right. I have one last question for you, Brian. Liz reacts negatively to some of the things people say to her after she comes back from Iraq. And this really rang true to me. It rang true to me as the stepmother of a veteran, but also as a civilian. And I just wondered if you, having gone through all of this research, do you have advice for civilians who want to say the right thing? Or, you know, do you thank the soldiers? Is there a way to support and be helpful? What is your advice on that?
I would say just ask them if you're curious about their experience, ask them.
Yeah.
You know, I think that I have a real problem with the sort of rote thank you for your service.
Yeah.
Response. Veterans have an incredibly hard time finding jobs because HR managers don't translate their work experience in the military to professional experience in the jobs.
Yeah.
So they're facing a whole host of people who are just giving them lip service and thanking them. I think what they want, what anybody who had been through an experience like that is just to say, hey, what was it like? And, you know, and actually be curious. Yeah, ask them about their experience coming home. Ask them about, you know, if they need anything.
Yeah.
I can't say I'm the best at that, asking people, you know, what they think. I mean, you really have to kind of know somebody. I have found that it has been a good, rewarding experience when I have had the courage to ask.
Yeah, Okay, that's great. I want to mention again that the book is called MWD, Hell is Coming Home. It's by Brian David Johnson, with whom I spoke today, and Jan Eagleson, illustrated by Layla Malevsky and Carl Stevens, and published by Candlewick Press. Brian, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. It's wonderful.
That, once again, was an interview with Brian David Johnson, whose graphic novel MWD, Hell is Coming Home, came out earlier this year from Candlewick Press. You can read more about Brian and his work at his website, bdjauthor.com. Tune in next week to hear a live interview with Vermont author Bill Schubart, whose new novel is Lila and Theron, published by Charles Michael Publishing, which is part of Simon & Schuster. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And then, of course, you can stream the show live each week at 99.3wbtv.org. That's every Monday at 3. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. Truly, I'm going to just repeat that. If you like the show, you'd do a great favor by going to iTunes, Facebook, writing a review, giving it whatever number of stars you feel it deserves. That's really helpful. Thanks. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I hope you have a great week.